This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, hi, and welcome. I am your host, Emmagan Awardner, and in my nearly 20-year career as a beauty and health writer, I have interviewed a lot of people. Supermodels, entrepreneurs, authors, celebrities, and doctors. And many of these conversations had a real impact on me, and I'd come away feeling inspired, excited, informed, and really empowered. And at the back of my mind, I'd always think, I wish I could just publish the tape so people could really feel that conversation. Well, on this podcast, you get to feel the conversation. I talk with experts, guests, and a few friends who I hope will inspire, inform, and empower you, and maybe also challenge you, whether you're looking for self-help, self-improvement, beauty advice, health insights, business know-how, or just some good old-fashioned life advice and a bit of a laugh. It's all here. Welcome to the show. Alexandra Hemmingsley returns to the podcast, and I'm so glad that she has. You may remember when Hemmo came on the show a few years ago. She had just written the book Leap In about open water swimming, or more to the point, facing fears and challenges head on. And previously I'd read her first book, Running Like a Girl, and had messaged her on Twitter at the time, just saying how brilliant it was because I was also very much into running at the time. And both of these books framed physical pursuit as a mental and emotional endeavour rather than a means to achieve a particular physique. And at the time, that was a really big change from the fitness narrative that women in particular were exposed to. Today, obviously, the conversation has moved forward considerably, but at the time, back in the day, Hemmo was one of the first to really nail this and put words to what many women were feeling about exercise, fitness, all of those things. Her new book is different, although perhaps not entirely. And actually, one of the first things that Hemmo says when we started talking is it's sort of an unintentional third memoir about bodies, but there's a lot that goes into this book. So when we sat down last time, we talked about Leap In, but there was a lot going on in her world behind the scenes. She was a new mother who had been through a pretty difficult IVF experience. She had been assaulted on a train when she was 9 months pregnant, and that subsequently went to trial, so she had to go through that as well. And her husband revealed her intention to transition. And Somebody to Love, the book she's written about this experience and this time in her life, is so searingly honest, and it's a brilliant memoir about how she dealt with a series of events that made her feel less like herself and lost in a way she hadn't experienced before. There's the IVF, and I've spoken to so many friends who've been through it who talk about how challenging that is physically, mentally, and emotionally. Being a new mother, we know that that's challenging in and of itself. The assault that she went through, and in one conversation, the life she thought she had made for herself evaporated, and she had to piece together what her future might look like while also battling feeling dissociated from her body and going through all of these really challenging experiences. Honestly, listeners, I found this book really profoundly moving. On the one hand, there's her compassion and generosity when I'm sure it would have felt really good to lean into the sugar high emotions of rage and hatred. But also, I don't think I've ever read a better description of how it feels physically to reclaim your mental and emotional health from the depths. And this is why, listeners, I'm extremely unprofessional in this show and I actually cry. Sorry, you can tell when you hear it. And when I listened back, I thought, oh goodness, it was going to happen because the way that Hemmo wrote about her own mental health via a particular section of the book where she's on this pretty treacherous hike took me back to my own battle with depression. So much so that even thinking about it now just makes me feel quite choked up because it is such a perfect, it really just made me think, if I wanted to ever explain to anybody what it was like for me, I would just say, please read this, because that kind of gives you a sense. This is an extremely wide-ranging conversation because we talk about everything from how we talk about women's bodies to what it's like to Have someone tell you that they're going to transition in the context with which it happened to Hemo, and what that meant for her in terms of how she educated herself. And then we talk about mental health and the assault that she went through. And there's a lot in here. So to kind of give you an idea of what the conversation contains, we discuss how the conversation around women's bodies has changed in the 10 years since she wrote Running Like a Girl, and how the experiences in her own life, particularly with the transition of her former husband, made her reassess how she spoke about bodies, and particularly women's bodies, why it makes perfect sense sometimes that you have to reach breaking point in order to be able to get to where you want to go to, the terrifying freedom of knowing it was never about me when her marriage ended, the judgmental world of new motherhood and how that felt and what that was like to navigate, the temptation of the toxic path of rage the toxic path of rage and anger, why it became such a mission for her and why it was so important for her to understand and support the trans community, the implications of the pink and blue world that we live in, and how essentially this experience really lifted the veil of how she saw the world and realized how it had been through something of a pink and blue filter. Why, when you go through a traumatic experience, has value in feeling all of your feelings. Her advice for anyone who feels lost, not like themselves, and who wants to get back to feeling whole again, if you will. And so much more, honestly. There is a lot of chat in this conversation, and I really appreciated Hemo's honesty and her generosity and just being so, so open. And I found it incredibly inspiring, I have to say. I found the book really inspiring, and I found this conversation really helpful and inspiring too, and I hope that you do as well. And obviously, I just want to pop a trigger warning in here. There is talk of the sexual assault that she experienced, so please be mindful of the fact that that will come up in the show. The links to Hemo, to her books, everything that we discuss will be in the show notes. But for now, please join me in welcoming back Alexandra Hemmingsley on The Emma Gunn Show. Alexandra Hemmingsley, welcome back to the podcast. Listeners, you will remember Alexandra from her first visit to the show, where we talked about all sorts, including open water swimming and running, because you are an author, a broadcaster and ghostwriter. And you're back on the show because...
Yes.
Well, a lot of time has passed. Things have happened.
Yes. Things took a pivot, didn't they?
Well, they did. And actually, that probably brings us quite neatly onto the fact that when I saw you, so we actually did our first podcast together in person, because no pandemic at that point. we did the podcast, we did it in your home, and then we went and had pizza for lunch with a friend. And you seemed absolutely fine.
Yeah, and it was a lovely day. It definitely was.
But there was
also a lot going on. Yeah, there was. I think I can't remember when it was spring.
We were just trying to figure out, Little Mix had just played nearby, or were playing that evening.
Yeah,
so it must have been early summery.
Spring, early summer, yeah. The person who was my husband when we did that podcast, no, when I wrote the book that we were talking about, the Leap In, and I had around that time, not long before, split up because she had realised that she had to transition. Mm-hmm. And my son, who was like crawling around making a whole load of noise when we were trying to do the podcast, was very small. And I'd at that point, like when we arranged to do that interview, I thought it was going to be quite a simple kind of chat, because I had that swimming book coming out in paperback and you'd read the running book years before and we'd always been meaning to have a chat. And then it just seemed like the trajectory of things was all going to be quite simple. And then by the time we actually did speak, it was a lot more complicated. And what came out of it was that I ended up writing a third sort of memoir about bodies that it sort of tied up in a bow the other two, and kind of like almost comes full circle, because it looks at some of how social media and the conversation around women's bodies has changed since I wrote Running Like a Girl, which I wrote 9 years ago. And in Somebody to Love, which is the new book. Yeah, I talk about some aspects of the publication of that book, which I felt really uncomfortable about. But other people have now published sporty books and have been marketed really differently. And that was what I was reaching for. And it's been really interesting to sort of see my place in the evolution of women's bodies and relationships with exercise and sport, and then to kind of loop back and look through the lens of my ex's transition and what I've kind of thought and rethought and all kinds of thinkings about women's bodies and what they can be and what they should be or might be or will be and all the rest of it. So yeah, there's been a big think.
So yeah, just going back to that, you talk about running like a girl. It's only when you say it there, I think actually you were one of the first people who spoke about exercise in that way, running in that way.
Yeah, it was why I wrote it, because when I got into running, all that there was to read to guide you, there was maybe the year Instagram was born, when it was still like just people using hipstamatic style filters. There was no kind of monetization or gurus there. And so there wasn't really forums for encouragement and discussion, and the runs that I describe in Running Like a Girl are pre-iPhones as well, so I was drawing the maps on my arms and trying to work out
street names on your forearm.
Yeah. And there was Sam Murphy, who's brilliant and amazing, and she did all the London Marathon. You know, when you get a place to do the London Marathon and you go to do the day and they teach you how to train. Whereas now, you know, you just put London Marathon into Instagram and there's a million training plans. Whereas then it was just Sam Murphy's books that you bought when you picked up your number and stuff. And she is amazing, and it's a great book, but it's a manual. It doesn't have anything about emotions in it. And there was a really big market for very male-led adventurous narrative nonfiction. So it was day 5 in the desert and my feet was stumps and my eyebrows had fallen off because of the sand, and they neither of those bore any relationship to someone trying to get round the park with a wobbly body. And now Instagram's gone so far that way that I see women with incredible bodies almost manufacturing, like leaning forward as far as they can to synthesize stomach rolls, because it's, you know, you gotta have a wobbly body if you're talking about exercise almost. It was a look at that as well.
Yeah,
it'd be impossible to look. I mean, my career had been by the point that my ex realized she had to transition, my career had been talking and writing and discussing women's bodies with women. So it was it would have been extremely disingenuous of me to continue to write and talk about in that area without acknowledging what had happened in my life. And it would have been disingenuous to have looked at anything to do with trans women without acknowledging where I'd come from in my journey, which was, you know, I made money. I lived for years off the profits of standing up in front of audiences and making podcasts like this, talking about it's okay to have a normal body. And when I said a normal body, what I was saying was a cis, white, usually able-bodied. And even when I was saying big, I was meaning 16, size 16, to kind of, and it was a very, it was a massive step from where we were, which was men in sand and training manuals.
Ultra runners.
Running like a girl. Yeah. That was a big leap because no one else was doing that. But it was also many steps behind where the conversation now is, where I feel like filled with cringe at my confidence in discussing the normal woman. When I wasn't specifying it, but I was thinking it was this extremely narrow window of girls who looked like me when I was growing up, because I didn't have any other experience. And that's on me. And that's kind of what I wanted to discuss in Somebody to Love, is how much else there is in the world. And also that what I really, really wanted to do was to show someone go through that thinking, because I think it's really easy to see the preachy graphic Insta post or an angry tweet and just think, hey, no, I'm not full of prejudice. I do nice stuff and I support women, without really thinking, well, where's this person that wrote this post coming from? There's so much perspective now. Mm. And I think that's what I wanted to sort of demonstrate almost, was the process by which I reached where I am now compared to where I was, and to be honest about that. Because the minute you kind of think, yeah, I've probably said some things which I'm would be quite ashamed of if somebody decided to trawl through my entire work past, I probably have, and I can see why I did it, and I can see that I wouldn't do it now, and I'm perfectly happy to talk about how I got there.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people are still understandably stuck in, but I didn't do anything wrong, it wasn't my fault. And it's kind of like, that's not an interesting conversation to have. The interesting conversation to have is, how do we unpick it and unravel and work forward?
I think it's important to be wrong, because the idea that you just get it right the whole time is a nonsense and so much pressure.
And all, yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. So much pressure. The panic of trying to retrospectively manicure your own digital or professional past. I mean, how could you sleep at night if you couldn't wake up in the morning and go, yeah, there's things I would like to move forward from now? And I think we need to get better, whether we have a kind of profile, as in, you know, you're a Hollywood star that gave some slightly shady sounding interview 12 years ago, or whether you're just someone with a digital output that can be called out on. We need to get better at acknowledging that we've done stuff that wasn't great, instead of going, no, that's not what I meant. And like trying to like Wallace and Gromit, like doing that train track while the train is moving. You can't, you have to acknowledge that stuff. But also I think we as consumers could probably do with getting a little bit better at letting people learn. I do think sometimes people are so, because I think especially like Hollywood level or super influencer level, there's been a lot of disingenuous apologies that we tend to think they all are, whereas I think some people do learn and are curious, and we have to allow space for that to exist.
You don't even have to be at Hollywood level. I think even you can look at Instagram people getting cancelled, and you don't even have to have millions and millions of followers. And maybe there's a reason to be cross with that person, but cancel culture, I obviously, is problematic.
Yeah, I think, well, I think the thing with cancel culture is that it doesn't really exist. I think it's like, cancel culture seems to exist to be discussed by columnists and chat shows, rather than actually living and breathing, existing. Like, you do not have a right to have your product consumed. And if it starts to feel outdated to people, they will move on. Mm. That's not cancel culture, that's being flexible and interested, and also knowing that things ebb and flow in and out of fashion in terms of conversations and stuff. Like, I definitely don't sell as many running books as I used to, because there are loads more people talking about that kind of subject. But I'm also really excited to read, you know, Paul Nobel's book, which is coming out in a month or so, and other people, you know, Bryony really diversified, Bryony Gordon, that sort of writing by talking about experiences of addiction, which I just don't have. And, you know, anything that becomes a monoculture becomes boring. And so I would rather the table was busy with interesting women chatting than, you know, lonely and powerful.
Now, someone listening to this might think it's so interesting that Alexandra's just said that her ex said that she was going to transition, and we go immediately on to the narrative about women's bodies and sort of gloss over that bit, because, and I know we're not glossing over it, but I read Somebody to Love, And I found it so utterly moving. And I've, listeners, you can tell I've already gushed over this before we started recording, because, and this is evident in Running Like a Girl, it's evident in Leap In, and I'm trying to say this in a way that it sounds admiring and not patronizing, but the strength of character and the grit and resolve you have seems to be just unparalleled.
Thank you. at the time, it's very difficult to sort of explain, because there were definitely mornings when I was staring at the ceiling and thinking, oh man, I've got to dig deep to get through today. Definitely. I'm not downplaying it. It was not an easy time in my life. It was probably the hardest time. But what probably came a bit before was harder, when I didn't understand what was happening, when I could see that my ex, who is a really, really lovely person, who I had known for years before we got together, who we were together for years of going through IVF, and who I have no doubt in any part of my heart really loved me and still does in many ways love me and wanted to do the right thing by me, had tried every possible avenue to find an alternative to confronting the fact that they were trans. And I think that's something that is common in all sorts of situations, whether it's, you know, lots of ways of, you know, all the L's and the G's and the B's and the D's and the pluses have gone through a version of that on some point of the spectrum. But it's also something we do about all kinds of things to greater or lesser degrees of let's try and avoid this from every possible angle. And I'd seen during that time, the conversation around trans lives become nationally much more prominent and much more toxic as well. So I could see why that you would have rising fear around that. And I have LGBT friends and family. So I'd sort of seen conversation around that. It wasn't like a total shock to me. So I could see why that would have been affecting her. And also it was awful, you know, it's catastrophically managed to realize at that point in your life when I was so vulnerable, but also it made perfect sense why you had to reach breaking point. And so I've seen a lot of people have responded to the book by saying it was like the biggest act of cruelty. And there were definitely days when I did think like that, but I was also at the same time really clearly able to see all of the surrounding factors that would mean and how hard she tried to be the absolute best parent, best husband as it was then. And in case there are any trans listeners, I should make this clear. Dee, my ex, and I it's in the opening of the book, I definitely never misgender her. But because it's very difficult to talk about your ex and be using female pronouns without you understanding that I wasn't all along in a lesbian relationship, we do have an amnesty on the word husband, just right. for clarity. And so that's used with permission. And because it's true, that was the legal position. I was never able to not see that Dee had reached a really difficult point and had tried every other path. So there was almost a sort of terrifying freedom once I found out that that was what it was. And I'd been in the mire of new motherhood when, you know, that is such a judgmental world to be in, of weight loss, whether you're feeding right, whether your baby's, you know, whether you're being strict enough or not strict enough and loving enough. And have you gone back to work too soon? Have you gone back to work not soon enough? To realize that what was happening with my marriage was absolutely not my fault is a freedom that very few women experience. And there was a terrifying liberation to it, to go, it was never me. It was nothing to do with me. I've tried everything. All we can do now is try and work our way out of this rubble as honorably as possible. And to have that sort of degree of ego and almost like sexual anxiety that can exist in the end of a marriage of like, am I not, do have you gone off me, to reduce it to its most childish. It just wasn't there. It just wasn't relevant to the conversation. And that was a really amazing thing. Like, I don't know. So like, I watched Coronation Street last night and Fizz and Tyrone have been breaking up, which will date this if depending on where you air it. And I did watch it and it was heartbreaking. And, you know, I've watched Coronation Street all my life. I'm really invested in those characters. And I was watching it. I was thinking, wow, I just didn't have to think that. And to some people who are very wedded to anger around trans lives, they just don't believe me. They don't believe me that that was a sort of freedom. There was grief. There was all kinds of other feelings that were going on. But that sense of kind of liberty to be who I needed to be was extreme in a way that at the end of lots of marriages just doesn't happen. And yeah, it was kind of an amazing, weird perspective to see it all from. Which was why sometimes I was happy having a pizza. Because I wasn't worrying if my husband had gone off with someone. Because the reasons were so weird and specific. Well, not weird, it's the wrong word.
Yeah, but specific. I think it's what I found so interesting about it is, I mean, did it happen quite quickly? Because taking the specific circumstances out of it, because not everyone listening to this might have your exact experience, but just thinking about you essentially had your world fell around your ears, essentially, like it was just a cataclysmic piece of information that just rewrote everything from that moment forward. And I know that you articulate it beautifully in the book. You were angry, you were furious, you were hurt, you were upset, you thought it was cruel, but it did feel as though, and the thing I actually found really beautiful about your story is how quickly you got to a place of compassion for the pain that Dee
must
have
been in.
Yeah,
well, I think it was because it was very visible that Dee was in extreme pain. And obviously, you know, someone who's cheating and can't decide if to leave their wife or their mistress is in their own version of extreme pain. But it's a very well-trodden path, that. And that this is what I mean about the sort of strange feeling of liberty. Because some days, don't get me wrong, it was unbelievably lonely. Because trying to talk to people about it, I found very often all I got back was how people would respond to it if it was them, rather than what I was telling them.
Right.
So I'd be saying, the things I'm worried about are, for instance, am I going to get used to using the right pronouns before my son is verbal? Because he was only 6 months old then. And I didn't want my son to grow up anxious around using words. I wanted it to be organic. And so they were like really sort of hyper specific things. Whereas my mum was going, how are you ever going to find love again now you've got a new baby and you're so tired? When are you ever going to go out and have fun again? And I was thinking, I've got a list of 9 friends who said, let me take the baby, you need to go out and have fun. And those were friends who were in turn freaking out about, you know, what would happen if their husband left them. And they were going, oh my God, make sure you nail her down to proper custody arrangements, because they're the kind of person that's worried about custody if they break up. And no one was actually kind of going, like, tell me. And this is not a fault in any of these people. It was just because there was no path for it. And if you look online, really the only path is a very toxic one of rage and anger. There's like, I'm not even going to say it because I don't want to add to the algorithmic powers, but there's like a specific term that women whose husbands have transitioned or exes have transitioned use amongst themselves. And I think I'm really glad I didn't find out about that till too late. At that point that it happened, I was like, it's a strange old world when Chris Kardashian, or I think she uses Jenna, is the only person who you relate to. And, you know, you don't realise how much you've absorbed and internalised. And this is obviously a wider point about LGBT communities and the lack of representation out there. But for as long as I'd been watching soap operas or going to the cinema with my friends when I was a teenager, or, you know, laughing at memes or whatever, I knew what the kind of breakup traditions were, that, you know, you lie in the bed and eat ice cream and cry and watch Bridget Jones, and then you go and get pissed and fall over in a bar and, you know, sleep with someone you shouldn't do, and then you get a bit angry and maybe cut the legs off some trousers, and like there's just, and it felt like in those instances everyone around you knows their lines. Like my mum would have known what to do. To it wasn't that she wasn't being supportive, it was that she didn't know what would be supportive in this instance. And it's similarly with the kind of cast of my friendships around me was, there was a lot of people scrabbling to educate themselves because they knew my ex, they didn't want to be upsetting to her, they wanted to be compassionate, but they would, you know, and then people would get like paralyzed about how to talk to me about it because they were so scared of using a wrong term because they'd seen, you know, someone lose their mind on Newsnight or whatever, that they were sort of too scared to even address it and would pretend it wouldn't happen. And in lots of ways that was really hard and really lonely, but it did mean, like, there was this kind of like, well, if there's no path, I'm going to make the path that feels best to me. I'm going to, like, I can't get, there's no way out of this rubble, so I'm just going to dig over here for a bit and dig over there and see, like, and I did have a very strong sense that I had my son with me. And I think it would have been, I mean, Dee is totally, we don't even have a custody arrangement. It's never even come up. We've always compatibly co-parented. But I had this really strong feeling that I was doing it for both of us. Like, I had to learn a lot about trans lives because he was always going to have to know. And I was going to have to put my shoulders down 2 inches and go into nursery and tell them and offer to buy the books if they didn't have representative books, so that he wasn't learning when he wasn't with me that this was what a family looked like and all of that stuff. So it was easier that I was kind of doing it for both of us. It helped me to confront some of it, but yeah.
Again, I find that really wonderful, the fact that, okay, it's that acceptance of the reality, I think.
Yeah, and this is something that I think I see people who I've admired and read for decades who feel sometimes, I mean, there's all sorts of things that are painful and confronting about the existence of trans people. I mean, I don't mean painful. It shouldn't be painful, but I can see why some people are. It confronts stuff in them if they've been brought up a certain way. But there is no denying that they have always existed and that they always will exist. And that a lot of people view it from a very white, kind of almost post-colonial way of the sort of heteronormative universe, whereas different cultures through different ages have had trans people in their art and have revered trans people and have normalized trans people. I mean, it is normal to have trans people, but you know what I mean? And trying to kind of now, after thousands of years of civilization and the accompanying art and relationships and religions around it, to try and now go, no, that's normal, not normal, that shouldn't happen. I'm going to put that on the internet and that will probably stop it. Seems to me to be an act of self-harm so extreme that, I want to say there's no one you're hurting more than yourself, but when it comes to legislation and like abuse on the street, that's not really true, because you are hurting trans people and you are hurting their families, because I think a lot of people take the angle that, I don't know, they sort of see trans people as if they exist entirely in isolation, just like in a sort of glass box, whereas trans people have children, they have partners, they have exes, they have siblings, and all of they you know, they exist in society with the appropriate and accompanying emotional ties. And, you know, my son has seen people kicking sand in the face of my ex as a two-year-old, which must have been, I mean, in a playground, not just like random sand. And that, you know, that's incredibly painful to know. And that's that, it's part of that kind of emotional landscape that I'm trying to prepare my son for, so that he can deal with that and see it for what it is and in context. But it's also like, mate, what are you doing? Like, all you're doing is potentially upsetting an innocent two-year-old. Like, it's, yeah, you can't make trans people go away because they make you think things you might not be comfortable with about what makes a woman.
It's very true. And you do obviously have a huge amount of compassion and have then spent a long time understanding or making the effort, taking the time to understand the trans LGBTQI plus issues and supporting the community. And I was really struck by the compassion you had in the book. But I wonder, when we're talking about self-recovery, if you like, how were you able to exercise compassion towards yourself? And was that, did it have a similar timeline or was it a different process altogether?
Yeah, it was, there were just days when my head was just so full, because there's so much that you take on when you have your first child, especially around body image and stuff. And when I had my son, he was born in 2017, which I think, looking back on it now, was the absolute glory era of Mumstagram. I think it was before that had become a tarnished crown to be an Instagram mum. And I was naive about the monetization of that universe and would sort of, you know, how the algorithm just, you know, gets one whiff of you buying a clear blue stick on your Boots Advantage card and suddenly the whole internet is like going, so organic breast pads. I mean, it's awful. It's really awful, because when you're having IVF, the whole world is waving its organic breast pads at you and you're like, well, no, it didn't work, mate. Can you just, you know, you can't tell the algorithm you've had a miscarriage until you've Googled miscarriage that many times that you've just, you're wretched. And so, I mean, I'm laughing about it, but it is really toxic the way that the computers are invading your brain at that point, because you're seeing much less of your friends. And I mean, people who've done it during the pandemic, I think they should all have medals. Because it's so isolating anyway, early motherhood, just on a practical level, that it takes you five times longer to leave the house. Your baby's sleeping and needing to eat at weird times. So your windows of freedom are, they're not there, but they're compromised. Your friends who have children at different ages might not want to see you. So there's all of that stuff going on. And then Instagram got added to it. And I didn't understand that these women were being sent all this stuff for free. I was thinking, oh my God, this, you know, spiraling costs for sleepy heads and, you know, certain kinds of mum rucksacks or like, I don't know, just, you know, special moisturizers for pregnant people and all of that stuff. And so there's all of that going on in my brain. Then there was like, not just educating myself on trans politics and trans lives, but also I really wanted to make sure that I believed what I believed, that I'd thought about it from all angles. I mean, when I think about, if people had seen me, like when my son was like maybe 9 months old, like when we were walking somewhere, I must have been walking along with like a kind of a cartoon thought bubble coming out of my head and like a sort of really deep frown, because I was trying to read everything I could around it, some of which was obviously really upsetting. But also I didn't want to just go, you can't just decide no one trans person and then suddenly like pick a team. You have to read widely, look at people's online behavior relative to their output. And like, I really wanted to really, really thoroughly look at where I'd come from, with my own thoughts around women's bodies and contextualize it, and because there are things that are confronting. And then there was like, my body was destroyed. I'd had IVF, I'd had a complicated pregnancy and a relatively easy birth, but I had, in the end, I had to have an elective C-section. So it wasn't, the day itself was very unstressful, but the wreckage of my body was stressful. And I felt like this, my superpower, I felt like I'd had my wings clipped, basically. I couldn't run, and it took a long time to feel comfortable swimming again. I didn't realize how much you'll use your core when you're swimming until someone cut through my core. Those spaces where I used to go to think and to have solace felt not available to me. And that was, I think that was one of the hardest things, was I felt like I'd been grounded, almost like I'd had lead boots put on, because I couldn't just leave the house and run for 40 minutes without the intention of setting off to think some things through. But you know what it's like, you feel the ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom of your feet start to match your heart rate, and your brain just kind of goes into the, it's like it goes into the back office and does some filing while no one's in the, it's sitting on the front desk. And it's a really beautiful thing that happens when you're exercising in that way. And it, and I didn't have it. Like, all my thinking felt like me scowling, thinking things through. And it was I think the only thing that probably stopped me from getting really depressed was the hour by hour neediness of a young child. And I think if it had happened when my son was very young, like when you've got a newborn and they don't even really acknowledge you, they're just like, you know, it's quite thankless, the very early stages. I was lucky that those dark thinking hours and days did take place when he was kind of 9 months to 18 months, which is like living with a really endearing, jolly, tiny, drunk flatmate who...
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
No, just, he's just such a sort of happy, jolly person. And it would be... like you'd be going, but then I read the thing in The Guardian took this angle, but then there was that blog, and that blog was by someone who is, you know, does have a PhD, but, and you know, they do sort of seem to follow everybody. But then what about the thing that they said on Channel 4 News? And then I'd be really like trying to work through one kind of really highly specific point of, you know, feminist politics or something. And then I'd look in the corner and my son would have found an old leaf that had been caught on the wheel of the buggy and would be squealing with delight and like rolling on his back with his new cool leaf. And it was just such an instant snap out of that, that it was like having like someone just kind of put a little basket of joy in your lap once every couple of hours. Whereas, yeah, I think if it had happened in the very early days, when you've got all the caring and none of the response and none of the kind of silliness, it would have been much harder. And also immeasurably harder to happen with a, you know, a teenager, where you were having... I never had to explain anything to my son while it was happening, because he was too young to understand. So as he has become verbal, he has learnt... he calls my ex something completely separate to me, but he knows that he's in a two-mum family, if you see what I mean. Mm. He know, so yeah, it's been kind of quite bespoke for him as he's gone along. But it's nice because he doesn't know any other way. He's never had to do the grieving that I had to do for a life I thought I was going to have.
I think that's the thing.
So that must be very, very hard to navigate, say, an 11-year-old through.
Yeah. I think that's something that you mentioned a minute ago. You know, it was from he was 9 months old to 18 months old. This wasn't a quick process.
Oh, my God, no.
Even though you came to a place where I think, and I said this to you before we started recording, I think the temptation when the world falls around you, when it just feels like, and a lot of people I'm sure listening can relate to that feeling, it can be very tempting and tantalizing to go for the quick fix emotions, like the sugar high emotions, like anger.
Yes. Yeah.
And even it doesn't even feel as though you indulged any of those. It feels as though you very quickly went, I'm playing the long game. And I'm sure that the fact that you have a son meant that obviously you're playing a long game anyway. But I just am curious, did you have to reject those sugar high emotions?
I did let myself feel them when I felt them. I remember one of my friends rang me up when this was all going on, and I left her a WhatsApp voice note saying, look, I'm doing this. I did a lot of it on voice notes because after a couple of phone calls, I realized people were just like absolutely floored. They didn't know what the response was. And then I didn't want to spend the next 20 minutes going, no, it's okay. It's okay. It doesn't matter. Don't worry. You don't have to get pronouns right with me straight away and all that kind of thing. So I did left a voice note, and she just left me one back going, I think the really important thing here is that you just have to feel all your feelings. And at the time, I just looked at my phone and did a massive eye roll and was like, well, yes. But actually, she was completely right. Like, there was no way to get around any of the feelings. Like, I had to go through, like, what's it, going on a bear hunt. There wasn't any way over them. There wasn't any way under them. I had to go through them. And that's true. I would have, you know... I never denied myself feeling anger, but I think the thing that I was clear-sighted about was that I didn't just feel angry at my ex. I felt angry at my ex and the world that had got us here. Right. And part of that world was, you know, some columnists or politicians or whatever who've significantly contributed to making my life harder by making trans lives harder, significantly. And in many cases, they've done it in the name of supporting women, and they have not supported me. They have caused almost irreparable damage to people's lives. And also just the kind of general pink and blue world in which we live. It was so obvious that things like that, and you know, you can't waste your emotional energy on going to Asda and getting furious that girls' school shoes are more flimsy than boys' shoes, because from the age of 3 or 4, the assumption is girls will be less active. It's legitimate anger to have, and, you know, and people do and can and will and should campaign around things like that. And I will always try and use my voice when I can. But I was in what was really important, and the thing I gave most effort to was not feeling angry, but apportioning appropriate anger to each thing. Because I was furious some days with my ex, but also I could see how all this other stuff had contributed. And I had been assaulted when I was pregnant, and I had a court case going on during this time as well. And the guy who did assault me on a train, he grabbed my ass when I was 9 months pregnant and denied that he'd done it. And when I went and moved to a different carriage, his friends came and blocked me into that carriage to tell me to take it back and that I was a liar. It was terrifying. And I was also very keen that I didn't get snagged on an assault court case and couldn't emotionally get past that because my marriage had broken up. But I was also really mindful that my ex shouldn't have to bear the appropriate levels of rage and terror that I felt about that incident, because she was nothing to do with it. She had never been anything but supportive on that day and through that court case. So I definitely didn't not feel anger, but it was a right old muddle trying to work out where to put it all. And that was, in some ways, everything, it was like I was walking out of a building that had been burnt to the ground. So it was almost like there was, I had this opportunity to completely rebuild loads of assumptions that I'd had. And in some ways it was terrifying because that was lonely. And I really did feel like I thought I was going to have to totally restart everything about my life. And it has definitely taught me who, you know, anyone who's been through any sort of trauma finds there's a certain sort of enlivening that it has in that the good friendships stay and the ones that weren't right for you fall away. And something that I found really interesting happened last spring, like spring 2020, was I was just starting to really feel back on my feet then. And I was getting, I'd finished writing Somebody to Love, which is the book about all of this stuff. And I was just starting to do the edits for it. And so I had a really very powerful awareness that you can be poodling through your life and absolutely everything can fall away, like you've been living in a house of cards. And I was suddenly keenly aware of the people in my life to whom this had never occurred. Because when the first lockdown and the pandemic happened, there were people who'd been through bad stuff in their life who were kind of either able to gather themselves and okay, I know what mode I need to go into, or who were like, this is bad, this is reminding me of dark times in my life and previous griefs or whatever, I need to kind of shut myself off a bit. And then there were people who I was like, oh wow, I didn't realize you just had this kind of blissful existence that you're this kind of spiraling. And I felt almost, I mean, obviously not about the deaths, but about the sense of a national emergency. I did feel an almost like a sort of giddiness that it wasn't just me. There was something awful was happening and it wasn't just happening to me. I'd felt so lonely for so long, battling my way through all this, that then it was like, everyone's in this. Wow, like you can go into the news agent and say something and they'll know what I mean. And, you know, just if you walk down the street and nod to someone, there's a real solidarity in that. And I'd felt like no one could possibly understand the set of challenges I was experiencing for the previous 2 years. And then suddenly the whole world was in this giant challenge. And there was something quite overwhelming about it this time last year. It was interesting to see other people's response.
I think it's interesting what you say there about feeling lonely. And we sort of come back a little bit to what I said at the beginning, because when we hung out last time, I would never have known to sort of put my hand on your leg or say, look, is everything all right? Or do you need to talk or anything like that? And it's one of the things people say to me now about the issues that I went through a few years ago. I felt very lonely. I was really struggling. And I went through a period of maybe not necessarily proud of it, but a little bit like you're saying, I think sometimes you have to feel what you're feeling. And I definitely felt a sense of resentment towards friends and
people who hadn't managed to magically intuit what you'd been going through.
Exactly. And just sort of like, oh, so you've disappeared. So, oh, you know, it just sort of, but then I also, as you just said, came around to the idea of you can't take everyone with you and that's okay. Maybe that's the right thing. So I just thought it was interesting about, and a few people I know who have been through their own traumas, whether it's mental health or what have you, have said they haven't felt the same pinch of lockdown because they already had those strategies in place to handle mental or emotional isolation and feelings of loneliness, and so the physical one was something they could actually handle pretty well.
I found the last few months of lockdown much harder than the first few months of lockdown, because there was this sort of sense of togetherness in the first few months that I had found missing from the last few months. And also I think the book came out and I had to talk about really difficult things a lot and do a lot of media around it and stuff, and it felt like it was very complicated to be talking about those traumas at a time when everyone else was suffering too. And it's been really interesting because there've been things in the book that I could never have known when I was either living it or writing it, that people have taken, people who've had babies during the pandemic have written to me several. I've been really struck by how many, because it was just, yeah, like I said, it's just completely out of the blue. I could never have put this in for those people, saying that they felt such sadness about not having their sort of maternity leave or their early baby years of, you know, sitting in a coffee shop, drinking cake, making new friends, or doing the baby swimming and all those classes in steamy rooms full of dribble, which is like the most toxic environment. And at the time you're doing it normally, you're thinking, get the antibodies, come on, who else can you lick? You know, have this thing off the floor. But when it's a pandemic, obviously you can't do any of that. And the sense of isolation of new motherhood without the one or two highlights in your week that ease that isolation. And people have written to me and said, thank you for letting me know that you can have real happiness and fun times with your kid as they grow older, that it doesn't just mean, like, that's not the only time. And I think that's something I really didn't understand. One of the things I was most upset and angry about when my son was really small, like 4 or 5 months before I understood what was going on, was, like, I knew I could only have one child because of all the IVF. I knew that was my shot. And I felt like this thing I wanted all my life had been taken away from me. And that baby times were this, I mean, they do go by really fast, but I was like, this is my only time to have this. And what I didn't understand is that your relationship with your child only gets more fun and more funny and more enriching, and you get more back from it as they become more articulate and more emotionally complicated. And that weirdly, when I look at my son's 4 in a couple of weeks, and when I look into his face now, I can really see baby him and 2-year-old him. I can see all the hims. And my mum has said that to me in the past, like, when I hug you, hello, I see you, and I see baby you and schoolgirl you and all the yous. And I definitely didn't understand that, despite my mum having told me it. and that is something which I hope people continue to take from the book, that if you suffer grief or trauma with a very small baby in your life, it doesn't have to be the story for your relationship. And I think people who've had children in the last year are just going to have hopefully the most joyful summer now that they can kind of hang out a bit more with other people. Because I think it would be, I think what I went through can't compare to some of the challenges of that, what mothers have done in the last year, to not have that support. I mean, that is heroic.
Again, so much compassion. One thing I do want to ask you about, though, because it sort of is a theme that's run through your books, and it's something I relate to, and longtime listeners will know this. It's not just the mental, it's not just the emotional issues or the mental issues or the spiritual challenges, not issues, let's say challenges. Mm. It's also this sense, and all the books, it's this physical challenge as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the hardest things was that I taught myself with running and then swimming that solace can come in your hardest times from physical endeavor, whether it is endurance like a marathon or a long swim, or physically changing yourself. If you can make yourself fitter, or I don't mean thinner, but I mean when you can kind of chisel away the sporty you from a bit from inside, someone who's been less active. It's such a sense, when you can see it in the mirror that you can change yourself, it does give you faith to believe that you can change yourself emotionally. And the fact that the journey was going to be 4 years pretty much for me, when I suppose it was probably, I would say my son was 2.5 before I felt like I was in anything even close to my own body, rather than the sort of disconnection that I felt from it. Because it was really, really, I mean, I haven't been explicit about this, I probably should. I found it extremely confronting and challenging to just, even though in my heart my leaning in my life had been to believe trans people that they're trans and that they have all the things I've said already. But to just be told, no, this can be a woman's body too, and for it to be someone I'd had a child with was really challenging. And actually, it wasn't as big a step as it could have been, because I'd been talking about how sport is a way to break down gender perceptions. And, you know, I'd written loads around women's football in the past and been saying, you know, we should be allowed to be as sweaty and muscly and it shouldn't be put upon us, and that we're not proper women if we're that kind of shape, and it's up to us to chisel away at our muscles and have short hair and have sports that are characteristically or traditionally manly. So it wasn't a huge leap, but it was a huge leap when I was already feeling very disconnected from my body by IVF and having a complicated pregnancy and an assault, all of which are things that make you just want to go, do you know what, I'm just going to put my brain in a jar and exist on this shelf for a few months. And my body can just do what it needs to do. And then to be feeling that anyway, and to have the confronting thoughts around, you know, women's bodies and trans lives and stuff, and then to not have my thing, which I was so proud of, which I turned into my career, which was to be able to kind of exercise myself happy, was really challenging. And actually, I suppose it's like that thing where you remember what you wanted to put on your shopping list the minute that you put down your pen and paper. I've just written a novel which is mostly set in Norway, and I went to Norway with my brother on a research trip, which involved a lot of very hearty hiking, and alcohol in Norway is like £9 per drop. So we weren't drinking, and we were outdoors pretty much all day for the best part of 10 days. And I came back having been spending the whole trip with the front desk of my brain. I don't know why I've come up with this analogy.
I love it.
Was really busy with like a notebook going, ooh, what is this flower? And I'm going to describe this. Ooh, how do they make sourdough in Norway? I was consciously harvesting for details for my novel and looking at landscapes and staring at maps and thinking, oh, look, that's the kind of house I want her to live in. Yes, that's exactly what I meant by that sort of path. But now I've seen one, I know how I'm going to describe it. And it turned out, by the time we were on the plane home, the back office of my brain had been going, finally, you've had the chance to not be in this state of absolute hyper alertness. I'd been sleeping short bursts of time. I had a young child. I'd say my son was just over two then. So it was a big deal to leave him with my ex for 10 days. It was a lot. And there was a lot of photos and FaceTimes and stuff. But it was the act of busying myself with something else that let my brain go, I feel great now. And I loved climbing that mountain, and I loved walking on that you know, really difficult gnarly terrain. But you know what, I think it's time I need, and what I realized I needed to do was strength exercise. I needed to go and do a load of weights. I needed to get my core strong and my hips strong and stuff. And I'd been so focused on those sort of flow states that I had kind of probably been making myself a little bit less fit by kind of running on not quite stable hips and things like that. I went to see a physio when my son was probably about 4 months old, and she was looking at why I had certain backache and stuff, because I'd carried my son very lopsided. I've got a thing called a bicornate uterus, which meant I really only carried him on one side. And she looked at me, and everything was really awful to my marriage, and she tapped me in my kind of solar plexus, and I almost fell over. She just tapped me like wear a long necklace would sit on you. She kind of like, with a couple of her fingers, she tapped on my chest and she went, you've really lost your balance. And I just looked at her like, I didn't even cry. It was just when two fat tears just fall out and just landed like either side of her where she tapped me, and I just nodded and was like, mm-hmm. And it was true though. I had to find my core. My stomach muscles were all shot from a C-section, and my back was all wonky from carrying him. And so then that had meant that different parts of my legs had strengthened by pushing buggies and all of that stuff. And I hadn't understood that. I'd never, It was so obvious, but I thought, you need to just go for a run and feel the wind in your hair. But I was just hobbling along in this kind of, and then that in turn was incredibly satisfying because I worked out that doing the weights and doing that kind of core strengthening was, it did help with everything else. It helped with picking my son up. I suddenly became able to kind of throw him in the air and experience more joy. And then I just did have this massive rush of helping my body to find my head and my head to find my body. It all kind of became much clearer. And then once I felt stronger in myself, in my body and in my mind, I found it much easier to get less kind of obsessed by the granular kind of identity politics side of it, which all of which should be thought about and should be considered and we should take seriously. But also I'd got to the point of like overthinking absolutely everything. And so I'm glad that that intervention physically happened when it did.
It's true what you say about front desk and back room. And I've described therapy before as, imagine that every thought that you've ever had comes out of a sort of ticker tape thing in your brain, but it just, there's no one collects it. It just lands on the floor.
Yeah. So
by the time you go to therapy, there's just a room full of loose bits of paper that are unorganized. And through therapy, you basically go in and you color code it and you find it and it's all very, and you have a lovely library at the end. So, and it's absolutely true, actually. Sometimes it's good to focus on things and take them apart and put them back together again in a way that you understand. And other times it's good to leave them alone and let them percolate because they sometimes do the work.
Yeah.
Do the work for you.
Yeah. And it's hard to know which one you've got stuck on when, if the people that you're talking to, or if you're not talking to anyone, have got too much invested in it of themselves, which I think is one of the really amazing things about therapy, is that on the whole, if you found a decent therapist, you're not absorbing what other people think about something. I think that's really, really, really hard. And the book Fleischman Is in Trouble is brilliant about that. There's a paragraph in it which I was like, yes, because when you get divorced or your marriage breaks down, a lot of people cannot hide their own anxieties about their marriage. So you know, what were the signs you saw? And I kind of had to keep going, it's okay, I don't think your husband's trans. It's like, and I imagine it's the same with affairs or like financial duplicity or whatever. I think people are, it's like they have to get a certain level of anxiety about their own setup out before they can be in any way helpful to you. And that's not a criticism. I'm perfectly sure that now if I had a friend whose marriage broke up, I'd be like, well, what it's going to be like is picking your way out of rubble. Have you considered stomach exercises for core strength? And maybe like, just because you did that, it helped you. But it is. That's the beauty of a good therapist, is that you don't have to take home what's making them feel better necessarily.
Yeah, it's true. We're going to talk about that hike as well. Although, because I found that so beautifully written.
Oh, what, the hike? Oh, Emma!
I'm going to get a tissue.
I'll send you. So, I mean, it was a few hikes, but yeah.
Because it was just this metaphor for the emotional and the mental struggles that you'd gone through and overcome. And then
there was one hike when, because I went with my brother to Norway. I'm gonna let you cry while I bore you with a story about my brother. And we hadn't been able to just sit down and really talk about this stuff because of, you know, I have a new baby and are you okay? Are you breathing? Do you need to check and pass you some water? And we got into this kind of funny little thing where we were on this hike, and in Norway it is pretty hardcore. Like there are bits where it's so steep that they've just stuck some steel sticks with chains on into the rock face that you just sort of haul yourself up on. And I'd be like climbing up the side of a mountain, shouting down to my brother, I tell you what, this bit's like the bit when I decided to stop breastfeeding so hard. I didn't sleep for 4 nights. And then there'd be other bits where it would be like you turn the corner and there'd be a view. And I'd be like, this is more like how it felt by March once I'd realized it wasn't all my fault. And it became this giant metaphor for explaining to him, because it did feel like I'd climbed a mountain by then, of like all the different rockinesses and exhilarations and desperations. And it felt like a massive release to be able to experience physically in a really kind of childish, graphic way what I felt like I'd gone through emotionally.
And I think that's the thing. I think obviously you can't see the energy expenditure of overcoming something emotional, yes, or dealing,
yes,
with depression.
So tired, almost like you feel like you've got too many tabs open in your brain. And at least usually your laptop has the decency to kind of get really hot and start going. And you feel like your brain's doing that and you want to have a way to physically display to people, like, I've got a lot of tabs open, please talk slowly to me.
Please be gentle. And I think that's what really moved me, because like coming back from depression, anxiety, all of those things, it's day by day. It's not linear process. It's not a linear process.
Yes.
But I definitely would say that when I think about it, I do think about sort of hanging on like cliff edges by the, you know, by,
yes,
my nails, that kind of thing. And you think that sometimes to show up as a really terrible version of yourself for your friends and your family took so much effort, which is why.
Yeah, but you're right. Like, sometimes when you say, like, when we met last time and you were like, you just seem to be fine, sometimes when you're thinking about that stuff so hard all the time, every time you're by yourself, and you are by yourself quite a lot when you've got a small baby, there's like wiping. You spend so long wiping things, bums, tables, high chairs, buggies, noses, and I was doing so much hard thinking then and really trying to, sort everything out. And it was so frustrating to not feel, you know, when you feel that tiredness when you've been to the gym and you've done like really specific workout. And even when you lower yourself to get into bed, you can kind of feel the glutes that you were just working. And it's so satisfying because you really know there's a sort of spent tiredness that's so beautiful to feel. You know you're going to sleep well when you physically kind of, and I just didn't feel, I just felt mentally tired. I just felt mentally tired and kind of sleep deprived tired. So a lot of those times people are like, but you always seemed fine. Like, it was like a holiday to be with people who were talking about, you know, Drag Race or Coronation Street or that. I think people always want to let you know that you can talk about your problems with them, but I don't think any friend ever should undervalue the nourishing value of talking crap about other stuff when you're having a really hard time, to move the spotlight from yourself to a really silly story about someone's hen night going wrong, or teenager asking an indiscreet question or whatever. Like, that is those are the fibers which are making the net, which is keeping the friendship going. And so even though, you know, it's good friending when you're being the person saying, how can I help, what can I do, tell me what you need to, what do you need to talk about, there's such high value in the shrieking with laughter at someone's WhatsApp during I'm a Celebrity or whatever. Like, that is like having a massage to your brain. And I think that's, you shouldn't ever not think you're doing that when you're with your friends, that appreciate the value of that kind of joy. Definitely.
Yeah.
Because it was of great value to me. And that's what I mean also about the silliness of having a small child at that age. Like, it's just really, really funny watching someone learning to walk. Like, when everything is so awful, watching someone and then they just fall on their big padded nappy bum again and again and just look really cheery about it. And it's, I felt like that's what I was doing at that point, was repeatedly trying to stand up and falling back down on a wobbly old legs. And my son would just be doing it, and with his little friends as well, and they'd be laughing at each other. And it would be like watching, you know, End of the Night. I call Uber in a minute. Shots first. They'd just be rolling around with half in, half out of a, you know, pram or something. Not pram, I mean. What do I mean? I mean a car seat on the floor. So, yeah.
Well, I know that our time together is drawing to an end. So I just wondered if you mind, for our listeners who maybe are in the thick of something like this, or have just recently experienced something that feels like the world has suddenly changed for them, if you have a little crystallized bit of advice that might start them off on the kind of journey that you've been on. Because I, like I said, you can tell from how I've reacted, like, I think that the way you've spoken about your journey is wonderful, and the how you've come through it.
I think one thing that I found really helpful, that I don't know why, but I always had quite a clear idea of this, clear in my mind's eye, like a image of it, was that I always knew that if I could get through this, I felt like I was stepping almost into the second half of my life. I felt like if I can pass through this okay, I will be really strong. Like if I can do it, I'll feel like I can do anything. And I do to some degree feel like that now. Like it let me leave behind so much, so many anxieties about friendships, about my body, about, you know, just sort of all the kind of toxic cancel culture, identity politics stuff that's on the news. I got rid of my Twitter, things like that. Like, I just don't, the stuff I thought I needed to be me that it turned out weren't what I was. And so I think obviously, you know, we've all got to live in the now and embrace the day, and I don't mean to disregard that, but try to imagine the you can be once you've got through this. Don't get stuck on the you that might feel like half-made guacamole today. Think about what you can and will be, because that was something I really, and also I think for me it was helpful, because when you're with a very small child, they are so visibly growing and changing every day that you have quite a keen, it's a bit like gardening, you have a keen sense of time and seasons changing. But if you're just by yourself, or perhaps if you've got older children, I don't know, might be harder to see. But I was very aware that there would be a me on the other side of it that I had to get to. And I think remembering her, if you're in that place now, and how great she's potentially going to be, could be really helpful. I don't have any advice about like moisturizing or helpful things there.
No, I love it.
Squats. Always do squats and hydrate.
I love that. And actually, I remember I phoned my friend years ago when I realized things were very bad. And I said, I know that I used to do this, but I can't imagine myself doing it now. Like, I've lost my sense of identity.
Yeah.
And actually, if I'd been able to reflect that and thought, well, you can be that again in the future, but better, then that would have been really hopeful.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think there were endless days where I was really focused on what I was, and that I wasn't the 30-year-old who'd written Running Like a Girl and could do 5 marathons and had, you know, spoken on the stage at literary festivals around the world. And there was a lot of grieving for that me before I could see, yeah, but you can rewrite the script and all that stuff. Like, your talks at the future literary festivals are now going to be more interesting because you've done all of this stuff too. And it took a while to kind of burr onto that me. But yeah, it did mean saying goodbye to the old one.
Well, listeners, I think you can probably tell that I would highly recommend the book, Somebody to Love. It's absolutely brilliant. The link to it will obviously be in the show notes, as will your social media channels, the ones that you still have. I'm also this close to deleting Twitter, FYI.
Yeah, I mean, it's deactivated, and I think it sort of self-destructs after 30 days. And I don't remember the day that I deactivated. So every day at the moment is like, I don't know, shall I go back, shall I not? And every day that I don't, I know I'm potentially closer to losing everything that's there. And every day that I don't, I care about it less. So we'll see.
Perfect. And I'll obviously also put the links to everything else that you put out in the world. But thanks for coming back on the show. It's been
Thank
so lovely.
Thank you for having me.
It's been lovely to speak to you, and come back anytime.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Hemmo and I. If you want to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. You can also DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Guns. Or if you want to chat to me and thousands of other listeners of this podcast, then please don't hesitate to click the link in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode, and click the link to join the Facebook forum. There are thousands of us in there chatting away about all sorts of things. So come along, come and join us. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.